Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is tape number 361, side one, November the 3rd already, 1978. There are so many important events taking place in the news right now that I feel kind of guilty taking up the time on this tape talking about things that have happened to me and my family. And on the other hand, I think it's important for you to receive this information because some things may be happening to you or your family or members of the family that you think are coincidences. And as long as you take these tapes and read the books that you tell me you're reading and buying and writing letters to editors and calling talk shows and making yourself visible against this fascism that the FBI made note that I was afraid of, you can all suffer from maybe different kinds of harassments, but some kind of harassment. So if I share some of the experiences that have happened to me, it may be useful to you to be alert for any possibilities that the same forces would like to come down on you or annoy you or keep track of what you're doing. I had an interesting week that I'll just go over in a few seconds before I go back and continue the saga of some of my experiences from 1970, where we left off on the last tape, up through the present time. Just this week, I had talked to Reverend Dumke, Patty Hearst priest, and had given him the week before the name of Dothard Perry, the FBI man that worked with Donald DeFries, because I feel that the way to get Patty out of the prison in California and to open up the case is a countersuit on the part of the Hearst and to expose the links of the counterintelligence program, specifically to Patty's kidnapping. And the this week in the Star, or last week, you might have to write to them. I think the address is in New York. The issue with Betty Ford on the cover, there was an article by Dothard Perry. That's one of the persons that worked with Donald DeFries in Los Angeles that saw Patty Hearst the day before the shootout. And he had an article, the October 31st issue of the Star, 1978, saying that the FBI knew where Patty was all along, all the time that they were in Pennsylvania and Sacramento, and from the time of her kidnapping, and that the FBI was up all the time on her whereabouts and was part of the operation. Well, after I talked to Reverend Dumke and told him to get this article on Patty in the Star, and I had given him some copies of information about Dothard Perry a few weeks before, Perry called me on the telephone. I hadn't talked to him for about a year, and I will be meeting him soon in San Francisco. And he reminded me of his work with Donald DeFries, and he has documents which he's turning over to Patty Hearst's lawyer, I believe, and her minister, of the correspondence of Donald DeFries with the FBI before Dr. Marcus Foster was killed, how they had foreknowledge of the killing, knew about it, and then the documents. He has the actual documents of that he took from the teletypes of the FBI on their information about the SLA prior to and after the shootout in Los Angeles. The same day after Dothard Perry called me, I got a telephone call from David Bucknell. I've been in touch with him for quite a while. He was the subject of an article that Mark Lane did in Hustler, and he had called me and wanted to give me the information. He was a friend of Lee Harvey Oswald's and worked in the Marines with Lee Harvey Oswald, and he contacted me again. Originally, when he had this information, there wasn't as much, I couldn't do as much for him as Lane was supposed to do, and now he's angry and wants to publish an article about Mark Lane and what Lane did to him and some exposés on Lane. And he's going down to L.A. to see Carrie Thornley. That was this pal of Oswald's who wrote a book about Lee Harvey Oswald. He worked for the CIA, and he was in the Marines with Oswald and in the New Orleans area. And Jim Garrison tried to get Carrie Thornley to testify at the trial when Clay Shaw was charged with being part of the assassination to kill John Kennedy. And a lot of researchers came down on Garrison because he wanted Carrie Thornley, but Thornley knows a lot and would be a valuable witness. But Dave called, and he's coming up here Sunday to the house. So just in 1 week, a friend of Donald DeFries, working an FBI co-worker with Donald DeFries, and a fellow in the Marines with Lee Harvey Oswald were in touch with me. I also got a telephone call this week from Dusty Sklar, a letter with her phone number telling me to call her collect. That is somebody I've been trying to get in touch with and didn't know how. She wrote a book about Reverend Moon and the Nazis. It's about the cults, the danger of the occults. It's called The Danger of Occult Thinking, and it's put out by Crowell Publishers, and Random House just bought up the book. It's heavily suppressed, and the Moonies are suing her, and the thesis of her book is that private persons find their own satisfaction in halting the progress of civilization by going into escapism, into these various church groups that are linked to Hitler and to the Nazis. And she called me and told me of her trials and her lawsuit of the Moonies against her, and I told her how I made my first contact with Paul Krasner. I'd taken the realist for years, and the Scientologists were suing Krasner. And I offered to help him in that particular case because I knew a lot about Sirhan Sirhan, and he had written in his articles about Sirhan and the Scientologists. That lawsuit was dropped, and I feel that I could help Dusty Sklar, and it's interesting that she contacted me at this time. So it was an interesting week in terms of being in touch with those people, and the contacts will continue. I want to get now back to some of the incidences quickly, if I can, that happened to us after 1970, after the accident, and go on to 1971, the summer of 71, when we took our first vacation. Barbara and Diane and I and several families, friends, went up to my property in Canada and went camping, and they were up there several days before we got there. Our trailer lights were cut. We'd pull in a gasoline station, and the attendant would say they didn't tear off. They didn't separate by tearing, but it looked like they were cut with the scissors. We had trouble with the trailer going up. When we got on the beach to dig clams, there were three people that had parked a car next to us, and they walked up to the beach and told us that they were acquainted with KLRB, Carmel, the radio station. I had just started in the summer of 71. Doing some broadcasts, doing my weekly broadcasts, as a matter of fact, and these people who I never saw afterwards or before came up to talk about KLRB when we went to another beach to do some more summer activities on that particular beach. They pulled up and they were there. We lost things on on the ferry boat going over from Port Angeles to Vancouver Island, and then two or three days later on the property, one item was in the middle of our trailer as we came in when we came back from fishing or camping. And unless you can say the occult, that people were leaving things, that made me feel very insecure. I had the feeling at that time there were people on our property that just raced through with cars that wouldn't stop and talk to us. And the same thing happened when we were up there camping this summer. People on the property that they may not have known that I owned it or why we were there, but they were faceless, and they'd race through, and there was this general uncertainty and harassment. After my Watergate story broke, the one why was Martha Mitchell kidnapped, I was on KGO with Bob Trevor. He had just been on the air about 6 weeks. That's when he first started at KGO, and I talked about the CIA involvement and the Nixon involvement in Watergate. After that radio show, a man named Bruce Roberts contacted me, and he had a selection of opinions and experiences that he put down in writing. He wrote them in letter form to his mother, and they became known as the Gemstone File, and he wanted to give to me an outline of the origin of Aristotle Onassis's money in drug dealing and the connection with the Golden Triangle down in Southeast Asia that he was very familiar with, and the role of the Vatican in drug dealing and in the OSS, the murdering of other popes, and he had a lot of information that went into what he called the Gemstone File, because when Maurice Stans destroyed the records at the offices of the Republican Committee in Washington, D.C., the committee to reelect the president, they were called the Gemstone Papers, and the secrets of dealing in gemstones and all kinds of illegal activity that took place in addition to narcotics were a parcel of corruption that's been going on for years. And Bruce Roberts wanted to give me a copy of the Gemstone Files, all of the letters that he had written of his experiences fighting organized crime and the political structure in San Francisco and around, as I say, Southeast Asia and in Washington. And I stayed with a friend. We used to stay on Geary Street. There's a large building of artists in this particular building that rented. And I have friends there, and I was staying there all the time that I went to San Francisco. And after Bruce left, we were very stimulated by this material. We didn't know what to do with it. There were no curtains on our window. It faces over to the Jack Tar Hotel on Geary, and Bruce got on the floor and crawled out so nobody could see him crawl out. We were crawling around in the dark, and this friend and I decided we would take a ride in San Francisco and just get some air and go out. And when we went out to our car, here we had this wonderful gemstone file on our hands that was unloaded to us. There was a man right behind us. Now, this was around 2 to 3 in the morning. And a man was standing right by the parking meter there, even though you didn't have to put money in at night. And we got in our car, and the car was broken into. And all of the papers, this particular person had a valise, and there were some paychecks and other papers. They didn't take the checks or really important documents, but the papers were thrown all over the car and just dispersed and scattered. And it was obvious that somebody had opened the car, I guess, with an instrument such as the auto club does. No window was broken. But we got in the car, and we drove towards, I think it was towards Fisherman's Wharf, and this car followed us. And then that began a chase for about an hour around San Francisco. And we looked for a place to pull up, and the town was dead. We went down along North Broadway and the waterfront and up and down the streets, and the car behind us got lost, and another car pulled out, a white station wagon, I think it was, a white sedan, and we got into a garage. The garage was closed. We go to a restaurant where there were lights, and the lights went out. They were just locking up, and we were really chased, and it was quite scary. I've never been in a chase like that, like the streets of San Francisco. Finally went back to Geary, and a restaurant was open all night, and we went in there and had some outrageous meal of fried fish or something, and decided to go back to Geary. No matter what happened, we'd just leave the car. I was exhausted. I don't like being up all night and being chased. We went back to where our things were, and the door was locked. We'd locked ourselves out. I was supposed to do a radio show at KSAN radio station in the morning from 10 to 12. That, I think it was a Saturday morning. And we went over to where KSAN was and figured, what the heck, we may as well be near that area. We were up and locked out. And so we went to the station, which I'm sure is always locked. And I had been there once before, and there was a waterbed in the lobby. So I said, let's go up there and just sleep on this waterbed. And as luck would have it, and this is one of the really strange things, how many times I have been lucky, with the exception of the accident that Bonnie and Barbara were in, or the acid that Marvin got. So far, I've been really lucky. I run those off again. They're not casual things, but they're instances that I was so close to something happening when some kind of a miracle happened. The door to KSAN was open downstairs, the radio station. I think it's on Post, I forget. Right in the heart of downtown San Francisco. And I talked to people after that, and they never left the door open. The door was open that night or morning, and we went upstairs, and in the lobby, the waterbed wasn't there anymore. There were some big beanbag chairs in the corner of an office, and we just fell down the floor and fell asleep. And in the morning, the people came in. They were making coffee and going to work at the radio station. It's an FM radio station in San Francisco. And when they came in, we were asleep on the floor of the place. And whatever happened to whoever was after us, I haven't any idea what it was. But it happened, and then after that, I didn't think any more of that incident. I went up in the summer of 72 to San Francisco to the Peace and Freedom Party with Flo Kennedy. And I stayed... you know, it was Louise James, my neighbor and friend, who just after this particular meeting went totally crazy and has been out of circulation, stopped all political work and demonstrations and activities and letters, and became really just like a vegetable. Mentally, she became like a zombie, and the state took custody of her and her belongings, and her belongings were taken from her, and most of them removed. Louise and I went up. She was an organizer for the Peace and Freedom Party, and at that time, somebody took my car to go around the corner to do an errand, and I didn't want to say no. And it was left in a tunnel downtown, and the gears were stripped. I had to stay in San Francisco for 3 days, and the German Motors was the only company that fixed the Saab, and they were closed until Monday. And Monday, he didn't want to take care of it, and it was on the way home. Finally, they did. So I had to stay in San Francisco from Friday until about Tuesday and spend several hundred dollars to get the car fixed. And that the car caught fire on the way home, similar to the time when I was in Canada in 1970. Later, I saw documents that the Peace and Freedom Party, the meetings that I was at, and these particular activists were in fact followed and had provocateurs and had agents at these meetings. This was part of the FBI counterintelligence program, and the Peace and Freedom Party and the women's movement in San Francisco were in fact followed. And Flo Kennedy was out on the West Coast. She had an apartment on Jackson Street, and I met her and was staying with her several times while she was organizing the women's group out there. And the FBI kept track of all of those activities. The evening of September 24th, 1975 was the night that a captain identified himself, Captain Christie, as coming from the Carmel Police Department. I mentioned that on the tape last week, that he had called and said that Barbara Bressel was down there and had been picked up at the beach, and we had checked her college class and she wasn't there, and that only a fluke by my calling back the police department again to say I'll be a half hour late. It was just a weird thing that I called, because a half hour wouldn't be late for her to be there even if she had been picked up, and I found out that she wasn't there, and that saved me something, a possible accident that could have happened leaving the house. And it was only because I called back that I was spared maybe a possible crash at that time. In 1975, I was teaching a class with Ray Fabrizio at Monterey Peninsula College on the political assassinations of America. And this was the second class. We had given one course the year before, 1974. And this class had just been started for about 2 weeks. And there was a gentleman that sat in front of the others, about the first or second row, who was very obnoxious. He seemed very anxious and very determined and out of control. And before I could even say a word, he'd ask a question. How do you know this? How do you know Oswald had doubles? How do you know Oswald was a patsy? And he began to recount details of the life of Lee Harvey Oswald, that the most minute facts that were in the 26 volumes that many people hadn't gone into, even a lot of the researchers. And I had the feeling, by the way he talked, that he was programmed to think that he was Lee Harvey Oswald, and he wanted to know how Oswald was done in for fear that he would be done in. And I was up in San Francisco doing a talk show on KGO after about 2 weeks of this class, and a caller called in and said, aren't you afraid of your life? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, I am right now, and there's somebody in this course that I'm teaching, and I feel that there's a possible danger around me, and I'm not sure what it is. And this man had gone to the instructor of the class who gave the course with me and told me of his affiliations with the Secret Service and the CIA, and that he did serve some part of a government as a government agent. And also I had noticed that when the class was over, he had a little stopwatch that rang exactly at 2 o'clock, a little buzzer, and he got up and jumped. And he came back then to talk, because people were still standing around talking, and he said, I have to make a phone call. So at 2 o'clock, the little buzzer would ring, he'd go off, make a call, and come back. When I got back from the KGO show to teach the course the next week, the college was in an uproar. The faculty, some of them heard about the show. There was this talk about jeopardizing a student, and talking about fear. I didn't mention the student's name at all, but feeling that I'm in danger in the class. And we had a meeting of the head of the university, Monterey Peninsula College, and the staff there and some professors. And I said, okay, I'll give you, we're ready to drop the course. They said, you can't do this. You're jeopardizing university. We could be sued. And I said, look, I have to protect my own life, and that is very important to me, and if not to you. I'll give you a list of questions about this particular student, and you answer them and bring them back to me. And if I get satisfactory answers, then I'm vindicated. And if I'm totally wrong, I'll quit. We'll drop the class. And it wasn't that far along that people couldn't go on and take some other course. So we had this meeting, and I made a list of questions about this student. And what I found out was that he was in the care of Dr. Ziegler at Monterey Peninsula College, Monterey Peninsula, not the college, the Garden Pavilion, the psychiatric ward, that he had been on the campus 2 years before and had been arrested because he had a machine gun and held down the drama teacher or someone in the drama department, and the police and sheriffs had come, that he was armed at the time of the class that where I was feeling danger, in danger, that he had been in Agnew State Hospital for 2 years, and he had connections with CBS or one of the major outlet medias. And he obviously at Agnew had been programmed or believed that he was Lee Harvey Oswald, and there's nowhere in a state hospital, unless he had some special care at a Tascadero, at one of the hospital that is doing the mind control and electrode implants, affiliated with one of the professors at the Monterey Peninsula College, I learned later, that he would get that kind of information or the books or the details. And I wrote to Dr. Ziegler at the hospital here, psychiatric wing, and reminded him of a new law that had been passed where a psychiatrist had been told by a patient that he was going out to kill his girlfriend. This was up at Berkeley, and the psychiatrist didn't warn her, and he did kill her. And there is a responsibility to tell people if their client is out there about to kill them or wants to kill them. And I sent him a letter that he would be responsible if this particular person went after me, that I felt he was programmed, that he thought he was Oswald, and that he was armed, and that he was not supposed to be back at the campus with weapons. He was there once before, taken away. And what happened was, I believe they took him back to Agnew. I didn't want him locked up in a mental hospital, but he was taken out of class. The full course went on. I was completely right about many, many of the details. And when they looked into it, this person was indeed dangerous to the campus before, even though I didn't know that, and I felt that he was dangerous to me in the class. So we were able to get rid of him, and the course of assassinations went on. I might say that in the giving the class at MPC the first year in 1974, there were about 120 people that got full college credit for the class on assassinations and conspiracies. It was the first college-accredited course in the United States of America, maybe in the world, on the American assassinations, and it was very successful. In addition to about the 120 that took credit for it, there were maybe another 50 or 60 that audited every week in lecture form 101. And because it was so popular, we were allowed to give it the next year in 1975. But what happened in 75 was, when people would call and ask about the course, they were told by the switchboard that there was no course. When they went to the gymnasium to list for courses that semester at Monterey Peninsula College, the assassination course was not listed in the bulletin and nowhere where they lined up for their classes. If you went in the hall for late registration in every class and course given at MPC that semester, it was in the humanities department, it was not listed there. If you called on the telephone, some people called and they were told the course is full, you can't come down, there's too many people. And those that came from Santa Cruz were told the course was full, or people had called me from Salinas, and they were saying, what can we do? Can you get us in? We have friends who took the course last year. I said, sure, I can get you in, just come. And they said, the class is full. I went over to the college. It wasn't listed. There was a bulletin of classes. It wasn't listed. So I went to class. I got a telephone call from one of the professors over at MPC, and he said, you don't have to stay the first day. All we're going to do is register the class. You can stay home today, and then we'll start the classes next week. And when I was getting these phone calls that they were told there was no class or the class was full, and I saw myself, it wasn't listed, I just got up and went over to MPC to the room where it was supposed to be the first day, and there were about 7 people there. And the professor got up and said, well, we need 15, and there's only 7, so drop this class and take something else, and another class in English or humanities or whatever. And I said, wait a minute, and I got up, and I was sitting in the back of the room. So I was on KLRB and had access to the media. There's a TV channel here that I did a noon TV show about this, and I did radio shows about it in the area. And I think there was an article in the newspaper and in the college paper. And then we got enrollment, and I got back with the people who wanted to get it, who were told there was no class. And we had about a third of the enrollment of the other classes because they had already enlisted and it wasn't in the bulletin. But we did have a class, and then others visited and audited. And again, it was a very good course, except that we had to invite Mr. Pullhammer in, who's in Navy Intelligence, who's from the Navy Postgraduate School. And I had to have another professor who teaches psychology. He's a Swiss citizen who teaches psychology, and Dr. Nevich, I think his name was Nevich, I'd have to look it up, I have a block against him, he's still over there at the university, and he was able, the conditions of our having the class was that we have a counterpart to contradict the assassination idea. It couldn't be just a course on conspiracies this time. And this one particular professor went in, and I tape recorded the session, And he told everybody that they should not be at the classes. They should be out throwing frisbees or screwing or out in the sun. That to investigate assassinations is ridiculous. It's a waste of time. And as a psychologist, you are mentally deranged to want to know what's happening. And furthermore, and this is the one thing he said which is true, these things are going to go on anyway, so just forget about it. And then he confirmed to a student at the class that he does work at a Atascadero, and this is that private little in-group where they do medical experiments, and the CIA has access to people who are just picked up even without an arrest and put into this particular hospital. It's in California. And I understand that he's affiliated with the Atascadero Hospital and that activities, and also teaches psychology, one of the most popular professors of psychology at Monterey Peninsula College right now at the present time, and is a Swiss citizen. He's not a citizen of the United States. In November of 1975, when I was talking about the origins of the Manson family and the SLA coming from the same counterintelligence Tom Charles Houston plan, I got telephone calls from Sandra Good saying that I was going to be killed, and I got a letter from her which said, "May, you are thinking yourself in a circle of madness. Charles Manson has been 28 years in prison, and all that BS you're running is only a reflection of what the news and books have programmed your soul's mind brain to. You are looking for attention. It seems as if you are looking for your death wish in the family," with a capital F. Now, the same Sandra Good that sent me that letter in 1975 had an article in, or there was a quotation of hers, October 1978, this is 3 years later, that was in the newspapers, October 29th. A question was asked in the newspaper, "Have Sandra Good and Squeaky Fromm," that's the woman charged with the assassination attempt on Gerald Ford, "ever expressed remorse for their part in the Manson killings?" And the answer was, "The two inmates at the federal women's prison in Alderson, West Virginia," they've been moved to California since, "still remain loyal to the Manson family. They say there was a secret purpose behind the murders in 1969. Hollywood has been a whore for years," said Squeaky Fromm. "You may not understand it, but you could come to understand it if you realize that Hollywood has sold a lot of our lives down the drain." What they said was that the family was a secret purpose behind the murders. There was a secret purpose. And what I was saying then and what I say now is that they were victims of an acid program to turn them into a helter skelter, named after the Beatles song Helter Skelter, to link the youth and the anti-war movement with violence. These women and men were used. They have been the whores not only of Hollywood. Hollywood has been a whore for years and sold them down the drain. But there was a secret purpose behind the murders in 69. And the purpose, like the Reichstag fire, when I wrote the SLA as the CIA, the Reichstag fire and the Patty Hearst kidnapping, to present terror and kidnappings in America and use these people as a medium by which to make superstars out of Mr. D.A. Browning, Mr. Bugliosi, Mr. F. Lee Bailey, the lawyers, the prosecutors, the investigators become the superstars. The youth are discredited and the victims are well chosen to be murdered to prove a certain point politically. I received a telephone call this week from Davis, University of California at Davis. They're having an ecology day fighting the nuclear plants around the country, and they wanted me to come up and speak about Karen Silkwood and her links to Letelier killing, gentleman representative from Chile who was murdered, and the political assassinations, and the relationship of the assassinations to the pollution and the atomic energy plants that they want for energy around the state, and the Karen Silkwood documents that she had to expose these people, and her links also to Watergate. I turned down the invitation. I don't like to do that. I like to go out and meet with these people and new young people and turn them on to what's happening. But there is a trauma, and the system knows it, in getting you hassled with airplane flights. In 1976, I had such a long series of experiences that If I'm invited now, the chances are I say no, even though I'm cutting off an audience that I should reach, and I'm not a coward, but you do get traumatized when you've had too much. And in 1976, I had too much. December the 20th, 1976, I was in New York City. I had another chase, somewhat of a chase, leaving as WBAI radio station. I was there talking about Howard Hughes. I'd go in there, and when I had some material printed at a print shop, PIP print shop, on 42nd Street, I sent it here from California. When I went there to pick it up, there was a man from the Howard Hughes organization sitting there when I picked up my material and telling me to contact Kate Glenn of the Hughes organization. They knew where I was in New York City, and when I'd pick up this material. I did a five-hour show on WBAI with Bob Fass, and I left the station because I had an 8 o'clock plane to California. And I thought I may as well go out to the airfield. The United Airlines was on strike, so I took American Airlines. It was just days before Christmas, so you can visualize how crowded. I'll do more on the other side of this tape of my airplane experiences in 1976 and why I'm really cautious about flying anywhere in the country right now. It really makes me very nervous.